Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga. Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga. Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga.
Welcome to this, the 98th of the Cthulhu Podcasts. I'm FNH. Today we'll be starting off with the next part of Through the Brazilian Wilderness. Then we'll have a 1927 jazz number, and then round off with today's feature, another story from Henry Kuttner. Let's get started. Through the Brazilian Wilderness, Part 58. On the 10th, we again embarked and made a kilometer and a half, spending most of the time in getting past two more rapids. Near the first of these we saw a small cayman, a jacar-tinga. At one set of rapids the canoes were unloaded and the loads borne past on the shoulders of the camaradas. Three of the canoes were paddled down by a couple of naked paddlers apiece, and the two sets of double canoes were brought and let down by ropes, one of one couple being swamped but rescued and brought safely to shore on each occasion. One of the men was upset while working in the swift water, and his face was cut against stones. Lyra and Kermit did the actual work with the camaradas. Kermit, dressed substantially like the camaradas themselves, worked in the water, and as the overhanging branches were thronged with crowds of biting and stinging ants, he was marked and blistered all over his whole body. Indeed, we all suffered more or less from these ants, while the swarms of biting flies grew constantly more numerous. The termites ate holes in my helmet, and also in the cover of my cot. Everyone else had a hammock. At this camp we had come down the river about 102 kilometres, according to the surveying records, and in height had descended nearly 100 metres, as shown by the aneroid, although the figure in this case is only an approximation, as an aneroid cannot be depended on for absolute accuracy of results. Next morning we found that during the night we had met with a serious misfortune. We had halted at the foot of the rapids. The canoes were moored to trees on the bank, at the tail of the broken water. The two old canoes, although one of them was our biggest cargo carrier, were waterlogged and heavy, and one of them was leaking. In the night the river rose. The leaky canoe, which at best was too low in the water, must have gradually filled from the wash of the waves. It sank, dragging down the other. They began to roll, bursting their moorings, and in the morning they had disappeared. A canoe was launched to look for them, but rolling over the boulders on the rocky bottom, they had at once been riven asunder, and the big fragments that were soon found floating in eddies or along the shore showed that it was useless to look further. We called these rapids Broken Canoe Rapids. It was not pleasant to have to stop for some days. Thanks to the rapids, we had made slow progress, and with our necessarily limited supply of food and no knowledge whatsoever of whatever was ahead of us, it was important to make good time. But there was no alternative. We had to build either one big canoe or two small ones. It was raining heavily as the men started to explore in different directions for good canoe trees. Three, which ultimately proved not very good for the purpose, were found close to the camp. Splendid-looking trees, one of them 5 feet in diameter, 3 feet from the ground. The axemen immediately attacked this one under the superintendence of Colonel Rondon. Lyra and Kermit started in opposite directions to hunt. Lyra killed a jacu for us, and Kermit killed two monkeys for the men. Toward nightfall it cleared. The moon was nearly full, and the foaming river gleamed like silver. Our men were regional volunteers. That is, they had enlisted in the service of the Telegraphic Commission especially to do this wilderness work, and were highly paid, as was fitting, in view of the toil, hardship, and hazard to life and health. Two of them had been with Colonel Rondon during his 8 months' exploration in 1909, at which time his men were regulars. His four aides during the closing months of this trip were Lieutenants Lyra, Amarante, Alan Carlisons, and Pyrenees. The naturalist Miranda Ribeiro was also accompanying them. This was the year when, marching on foot through an absolutely unknown wilderness, the colonel and his party finally reached the Gy Parana, which on the maps was then, and on most maps is now, placed in an utterly wrong course, and over a degree out of its real position. When they reached the affluence of the Gy Parana, a third of the members of the party were so weak with fever that they could hardly crawl. They had no baggage. Their clothes were in tatters, and some of the men were almost naked. For months they had had no food except what little game they shot, and especially the wild fruits and nuts. If it had not been for the great abundance of the Brazil nuts, they would have all died. At the first big stream they encountered, they built a canoe, and Alan Carlisons took command of it and descended to map the course of the river. With him went Ribeiro, the doctor Tanagenera, who could no longer walk on account of the ulceration of one foot, three men whom the fever had rendered unable to walk, and six men who were as yet well enough to handle the canoe. By the time the remainder of the party came to the next navigable river, 11 more fever-stricken men had nearly reached the end of their tether. Here they ran across a poor devil who had for 4 months been lost in the forest and was dying of slow starvation. He had eaten nothing but Brazil nuts and the grubs of insects. He could no longer walk but could sit erect and totter feebly for a few feet. Another canoe was built, and in it Pyrineus started downstream with the 11 fever patients and the starving wanderer. Colonel Rondon kept up the morale of his men by still carrying out the forms of military discipline. The ragged bugler had his bugle. Lieutenant Pyrineus had lost every article of clothing except a hat and a pair of drawers. The half-naked lieutenant drew up his 11 fever patients in line. The bugle sounded. Everyone came to attention, and the haggard colonel read out the orders of the day. Then the dugout, with its load of sick men, started downstream, and Rondon, Lyra, Amarante, and the 12 remaining men resumed their weary march. When a fortnight later they finally struck a camp of rubber-gatherers, 3 of the men were literally and entirely naked. Meanwhile, Amilcar had descended the Jaqui Paraná a month or two previously, with provisions to meet them. For at that time the maps incorrectly treated this river as the larger, instead of the smaller Guy Paraná, which they were in fact ascending, and Colonel Rondon had supposed that they were going down the former stream. Amilcar returned after himself suffering much hardship and danger. The different parties finally met at the mouth of the Guy Paraná, where it enters the Madeira. The lost man, whom they had found, seemed on the road to recovery, and they left him at a ranch on the Madeira. Yet, after they had left him, they heard that he had died. This week's music is from 1927. It's by Divine's Wisconsin Roof Orchestra, and it's a Tiger Rag. I warn you now, it cuts off very sharp at the end, but it's such a jolly number I had to include it anyway. Thank you. I warned you it was a bit sharp at the end there. Anyway, we're now on to the main feature. The Secret of Kralitz by Henry Kuttner. I awoke from profound sleep to find two black-swathed forms standing silently beside me, their faces pale blurs in the gloom. As I blinked to clear my sleep-dimmed eyes, one of them beckoned impatiently, and suddenly I realized the purpose of this midnight summons. For years I had been expecting it, ever since my father, the Baron Kralitz, had revealed to me the secret and the curse that hung over our ancient house. And so, without a word, I rose and followed my guides as they led me along a gloomy corridor of the castle that had been my home since birth. As I proceeded, there rose up in my mind the stern face of my father, and in my ears rang the solemn words as he told me of the legendary curse of the House of Kralitz, the unknown secret that was imparted to the eldest son of each generation at a certain time. When, I asked my father, as he lay on his deathbed, fighting back the approach of dissolution. When you're able to understand, he had told me, watching my face intently from beneath his tufted white brows. Some are told the secret sooner than others. Since the first Baron Kralitz, the secret has been handed down. He clutched at his breast and paused. It was fully 5 minutes before he had gathered his strength to speak again in his rolling, powerful voice. No gasping deathbed confessions for the Baron Kralitz. He said at last, "You have seen the ruins of the old monastery near the village, Franz. The first Baron burnt it and put the monks to the sword. The abbot interfered too often with the Baron's whims. A girl sought shelter and the abbot refused to give her up at the Baron's demand. His patience was at an end. You know the tales, they still tell about him. He slew the abbot, burned the monastery, and took the girl. Before he died, the abbot cursed his slayer and cursed his sons for unborn generations. And it is the nature of this curse that is the secret of our house. I may not tell you what the curse is. Do not seek to discover it before it is revealed to you. Wait patiently, and in due time you will be taken by the warders of the secret down the stairway to the underground cavern. And then you will learn the secret of the Kralitz." As the last word passed my father's lips, he died, his stern face still set in its harsh lines. Deep in my memories, I had not noticed our path, but now the dark forms of my guides paused beside a gap in the stone flagging, where a stairway which I had never seen during my wanderings about the castle led into the subterranean depths. Down this stairway I was conducted, and presently I came to realize that there was a light of a sort, a dim, phosphorescent radiance that came from no recognizable source, and seemed to be less actual light than an accustoming of my eyes to the near darkness. I went down for a long time. The stairway turned and twisted in the rock, and the bobbling forms ahead of me were my only relief from the monotony of the interminable descent. And at last, deep underground, the long stairway ended, and I gazed over the shoulders of my guides at the great door that barred my path. It was roughly chiselled from old solid stone, and upon it were curious and strangely disquieting carvings, symbols which I did not recognize. It swung open, and I passed through and paused, staring about me through a grey sea of mist. I stood upon a gentle slope that fell away into the fog-hidden distance, from which came a pandemonium of muffled bellowing and high-pitched squeals and squeakings, vaguely akin to obscene laughter. Dark, half-glimpsed shapes swam into sight through the haze and disappeared again, and great vague shadows swept overhead on silent wings. Almost beside me was a long rectangular table of stone, and at this table 20 of men were seated. They were watching me from eyes that gleamed dully out of deep sockets. My two guides silently took their places amongst them. And suddenly the thick fog began to lift. It was swept raggedly away on the breath of a chill wind. The far, dim reaches of the cavern were revealed as the mist swiftly dissipated, and I stood silent in the grip of a mighty fear, and strangely, an equally portent, unaccountable thrill of delight. A part of my mind seemed to ask, "What horror is this?" And another part whispered, "You know this place." But I could never have seen it before. If I had realized what lay far beneath the castle, I could never have slept at night for the fear that would have obsessed me. for standing, silent with conflicting tides of horror and ecstasy racing through me, I saw the weird inhabitants of this underground world. Demons, monsters, unnameable things, nightmare colossi strode bellowing through the murk, and amorphous grey things like giant slugs walked upright on stumpy legs. Creatures of shapeless soft pulp, beings with flame-shot eyes scattered over their misshapen bodies like the fabled Argus, they writhed and twisted there in the evil glow. Winged things that were not bats swooped and fluttered in the timbrous air, whispering sibilantly, whispering in human voices. Far away at the bottom of the slope, I could see the chill gleam of water, a hidden, sunless sea. Shapes, mercifully almost hidden by the distance and the semi-darkness, sported and cried, troubling the surface of this lake, the size of which I could only conjecture. And a flapping thing whose leathery wings stretched like a tent above my head swooped and hovered for a moment, staring with flaming eyes, and then darted off and was lost in the gloom. And all the while, as I shuddered with fear and loathing, within me was this evil glee, this voice which whispered, "You know this place. You belong here. Is it not good to be home?" I glanced behind me. The great door had swung silently shut, and escape was impossible. And then pride came to my aid. I was a Kralitz, and a Kralitz would not acknowledge fear in the face of the devil himself. I stepped forward and confronted the warders, who were still seated regarding me intently from eyes in which a smouldering fire seemed to burn. Fighting down an insane dread that I might find before me an array of fleshless skeletons, I stepped to the head of the table, where there was a sort of crude throne, and I peered closely at the silent figure on my right. It was no bare skull at which I gazed, but a bearded, deadly pale face. The curved, voluptuous lips were crimson, looking almost rouged, and the dull eyes stared through me bleakly. Inhuman agony had etched itself in deep lines on the white face, and gnawing anguish smouldered in the sunken eyes. I cannot hope to convey the utter strangeness, the atmosphere of the unearthliness that surrounded him, almost as palpable as the fetid tomb stench that whirled from the dark garments he wore. He waved a black swathed arm to the vacant seat at the head of the table, and I sat down. This nightmare sense of unreality. I seemed to be in a dream, with a hidden part of my mind slowly waking from sleep into evil life to take command of my faculties. The table was set with old-fashioned goblets and trenchers, such as not been used for hundreds of years. There was meat on the trenchers, and red liquor in the jewelled goblets. A heady, overpowering fragrance swam up into my nostrils, mixed with the grave smell of my companions and the musty odour of a dank and sunless place. Every white face was turned towards me. Faces that seemed oddly familiar, although I didn't know why. Each face was alike in its blood-red sensual lips, and its expression of gnawing agony and burning black eyes like the abysmal pits of Tartarus, and they stared at me, until I felt the short hairs stir on the back of my neck. But I was a Kralitz. I stood up and said boldly in archaic German that somehow came familiarly from my lips, "I am Franz, 21st Baron Kralitz. What do you want with me?" A murmur of approval went around the long table. There was a stir. From the foot of the board, a huge bearded man arose, a man with a frightful scar that made the left side of his face a horror of healed white tissue. Again the odd thrill of familiarity ran through me. I'd seen that face before, and vaguely I remembered looking at it through dim twilight. The man spoke in the old guttural German. "We greet you, Franz, Baron Kralitz. We greet you and pledge you, Franz, and we pledge the House of Kralitz." With that he caught up the goblet before him and held it high. All along the long table the black swathed ones arose, and each held high his jewelled cup and pledged me. They drank deeply, savouring the liquor, and I made the bow custom demanded. I said in words that sprang almost unbidden to my mouth, "I greet you, who are the wardens of the secret of Kralitz, and I pledge you in return." All about me, to the farthermost reaches of the dim cavern, a hush fell, and the bellows and howlings and the insane twittering of the flying things were no longer heard. My companions leaned expectantly towards me, Standing alone at the head of the board, I raised my goblet and drank. The liquor was heady, exhilarating, with a faintly brackish flavour. And abruptly I knew why the pain-racked, ruined face of my companion had seemed familiar. I'd seen it often among the portraits of my ancestors, the frowning, disfigured visage of the founder of the House of Kralitz that glared down from the gloom of the Great Hall. In that fierce white light of revelation, I knew my companions for what they were. I recognized them one by one, remembering their canvas counterparts. But there was a change. Like an impalpable veil, the stamp of ineradicable evil lay on the tortured faces of my hosts, strangely altering their features, so that I could not always be sure I recognized them. One pale, sardonic face reminded me of my father, but I could not be sure, so monstrously altered was its expression. I was dining with my ancestors, the House of Kralitz. My cup was still held high, and I drained it, for somehow the grim revelation was not entirely unexpected. A strange glow thrilled through my veins, and I laughed aloud for the evil delight that was in me. The others laughed too, a deep-throated merriment like the barking of wolves, tortured laughter from men stretched on the rack, mad laughter in hell. And all through the hazy cavern came the clamour of the devil's brood. Great figures that towered many spans high rocked with thundering glee, and the flying things tittered slyly overhead. And out over the vast expanse swept the wave of frightful mirth, until the half-seen things in the black water sent out bellows that tore at my eardrums and the unseen roof far overhead. And I laughed with them, laughed insanely, until I dropped exhausted into my seat and watched the scarred man at the other end of the table as he spoke. "You are worthy to be of our company, and worthy to eat at the same board. We have pledged each other, and you are one of us. We shall eat together." And we fell too, tearing like hungry beasts at the succulent white meat in the jewelled trenches. Strange monsters served us, and at a chill touch on my arm I turned to find a dreadful crimson thing, like a skinned child refilling my goblet. Strange, strange and utterly blasphemous was our feast. We shouted and laughed and fed, there in that hazy light, while all around us thundered the evil horde. There was hell beneath Castle Kralitz, and it held high carnival this night. Presently we sang a fierce drinking song, swinging the deep cups back and forth in rhythm with our shouted chant. It was an archaic song, but the obsolete words were no handicap, for I mouthed them as though they had been learned at my mother's knee. And at the thought of my mother, a trembling and a weakness ran through me abruptly, and I banished it with a draught of the heady liquor. Long, long we shouted and sang, and caroused there in the great cavern, and after a time we arose together and trooped to where a narrow, high-arched bridge spanned the tenebrous waters of the lake. But I may not speak of what was at the other end of the bridge, nor of the unnameable things that I saw and did. I learned of the fungoid inhuman beings that dwell on far cold Yoggoth, of the cyclopean shapes that attend unsleeping Cthulhu in his submarine city, of the strange pleasures that the followers of leprous subterranean Yog-Sothoth may possess, and I learned too of the unbelievable manner in which Iod, the Source, is worshipped beyond the outer galaxies. I plumbed the blackest pits of hell and came back laughing. I was one with the rest of those dark warders, and I joined them in the Saturnalia of horror until the scarred man spoke to us again. "Our time grows short," he said, his scarred and bearded white face like a gargoyle's in the half-light. "We must depart soon. But you are a true Kralitz, friends, and we shall meet again, and feast again, and make merry far longer than you think. One last pledge." I gave it to him. "To the House of Kralitz, may it never fall." And with an exultant shout we drained the pungent dregs of the liquor. Then a strange lassitude fell upon me. With the others, I turned my back on the cavern and the shapes that pranced and bellowed and crawled there, and I went up through the carved stone portal. We filed up the stairs, up and up endlessly, until at last we emerged through the gaping hole in the stone flags and preceded a dark, silent company back through those interminable corridors. the surroundings began to grow strangely familiar, and suddenly I recognized them. We were in the great burial vaults below the castle, where the Baron's Kralets were ceremoniously entombed. Each Baron had been placed in his stone casket in his separate chamber, and each chamber lay like beads on a necklace adjacent to the next, so that we proceeded from the furthermost tombs of the early Baron Kralets towards the unoccupied vaults. By immemorial custom, each tomb lay bare an empty mausoleum until the time had come for its use, when the great stone coffin with the memorial inscription carved upon it would be carried to its place. It was fitting indeed for the secret of Kralets to be hidden here. Abruptly I realized that I was alone, save for the bearded man with the disfiguring scar. The others had vanished, and deep in my thoughts I had not missed them. My companion stretched out his black swathed arm and halted my progress, and I turned to him questioningly. He said in his sonorous voice, "I must leave you now. I must go back to my own place," and he pointed to the way whence we had come. I nodded, for I had already recognized my companions for what they were. I knew that each Baron Kralets had been laid in his tomb only to arise as a monstrous thing neither dead nor alive, to descend into the cavern below and take part in the evil Saturnalia. I realized, too, that with the approach of dawn they had returned to their stone coffins, to lie in a death-like trance until the setting sun should bring brief liberation. My own occult studies had enabled me to recognize these dreadful manifestations. I bowed to my companion, and would have proceeded on my own way to the upper parts of the castle, but he barred my path. He shook his head slowly, his scar hideous in the phosphorescent gloom. I said, "May I not go yet?" He stared at me with tortured, smouldering eyes that had looked into hell itself, and he pointed to what lay beside me. And in a flash of nightmare realization, I knew the secret of the curse of the Kralets. There came to me the knowledge that made my brain a frightful thing in which shapes of darkness would ever swirl and scream. The dreadful comprehension of when each Baron Kralets was initiated into the Brotherhood of Blood. I knew that no coffin had ever been placed unoccupied into the tombs. And I read upon the stone sarcophagus at my feet the inscription that made my doom known to me. My own name, Franz, 21st Baron Kralets. And that's all the story for today. So that's it, except to remind you that the opening music is by Victor Valdez from The Symbol Project. This file is released on an attribution, non-commercial, share-alike license. Until next time.
CthulhuPodcast.co.uk